Though a more peaceful evening across Texas, voices continue to rise over police force against African Americans and people of color. We'll have the latest today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Amid days of demonstrations over policing, a former Texas mayor and one-time presidential candidate decides it's time for a full-throated endorsement of Joe Biden. Our conversation with Julian Castro on what was, for him, a tipping point. Also, the return of the Brown Berets to El Paso and an attempt to get back to normal at Texas A&M. We'll talk with the system's chancellor and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this third day of June 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us and hope your Wednesday has been a good one so far. Thanks, but no thanks may be a charitable way of characterizing Governor Greg Abbott's message yesterday as he met with reporters in Dallas. Asked about whether Texas would take up the president's offer for military forces to augment state clampdowns on looters, an offer that was also expressed as a threat to states that didn't do more, Governor Abbott said, and I want to quote him here, "We will not be asking the United States military to come into the state of Texas because we know that Texans can take care of Texans." Close quote. The Department of Public Safety has already dispatched nearly 3,000 troopers across the Lone Star State and activated the Texas National Guard to augment police departments, too. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with a former presidential candidate from Texas, calling for the demilitarization of police, as well as other changes to policing. But first, an update on a fifth day of demonstrations in cities across Texas, protesting the death of Houston native George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody, as well as the use of force against people of color by police more generally. Marchers took to the streets of Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston, demanding change, many cities reporting a quieter night. Earlier, a crowd that the Texas Tribune estimated to be some 60,000 strong rallied in the state's biggest city. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has more.
The massive rally drew thousands of people of all ages and different races. Many wore black t-shirts and masks. Before they set off on the march, they chanted some of George Floyd's final words, "I can't breathe." Rappers and elected officials joined Floyd's extended family in the largely peaceful protest against police violence in the wake of his death. Protesters like Bryson Gresham marched from Houston's downtown park, Discovery Green, to City Hall.
I'm feeling mad. I'm feeling sad. Also confused at the same time. Like, I don't understand, like, why people treat us this way.
Floyd's family and other organizers urged everyone to demonstrate peacefully.
They're expecting you to behave unbecomingly. They're expecting you to carry yourself like a fool, but we don't have to do that.
That's one of Floyd's family members who spoke at the rally. The family's message focused on coming together. One of Floyd's brothers found some comfort with the crowd.
I love y'all. Don't forget that, man. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for y'all. I'd be in a shack that's tied up, sitting down, man. I'm hurt. I love my brother, man.
Another member of Floyd's grieving family asked people to stay involved.
We know that we are just beginning the fight. It's going to be more like a marathon. And we hope that y'all continue to support us as we seek justice for our cousin and our brother.
That call to action resonated with college student Serrano Davis. He's already thinking of his next steps, vote in national and local elections.
You know, we've gone time and time making protests, but nothing really happens whenever we're not making the right informed votes to ensure that whether it's the district attorney's office or the actual chief of police office, that's ensuring that, you know, they're not hiring and they're going through the right background checks in terms of training these policemen.
Davis says he was worried the protests may get violent, like in other U.S. cities like Minneapolis. As the main rally wrapped up, many protesters lingered and police tried to break them up with pepper spray, though the vast majority of the rally remained peaceful. Hundreds hung back in the streets of downtown Houston, some chanting the name of the latest black person to be killed by police. A public viewing and funeral for George Floyd are scheduled for next week in Southwest Houston. It's expected to draw another large crowd, including the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, Joe Biden. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
Among those who've long expressed concern over police tactics is Julian Castro, former mayor of San Antonio, also former Housing and Urban Development Secretary, and more recently, a Democratic presidential candidate. Yesterday, Castro was back in the headlines, doing something he'd not done since withdrawing from the race, issuing an unequivocal endorsement of the presumptive Democratic nominee, Joe Biden. Secretary Castro, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
My pleasure.
The first thing that a lot of people said when you began tweeting yesterday, and I'll just use the words of the San Antonio Express News. Castro has been noticeably absent from the campaign trail for Biden, while other former Democratic contenders for the White House, including Beto O'Rourke and Elizabeth Warren, have done campaign events for Biden. Castro had offered limited expressions of support. But yesterday, all that changed. What changed in you?
I was very impressed yesterday when I watched Vice President Biden's speech from Philadelphia with the specific reforms that he put forward to begin the healing in this country by doing real police reform. I made police reform a big part of my vision for the future of this country because I know that so many people deal with that on a daily basis. Every now and then we see one of these instances like we saw with George Floyd or Eric Garner or any number of other individuals, but every day people deal with that issue and we don't grapple with it enough in this country. Right now, what we're going through is years and years of frustration that especially the Black community feels because we have not dealt with police reform. He's ready to deal with it. And so I wanted to express my full support and offer any help that I can give to make sure that he defeats Donald Trump and that he gets this police reform agenda done as president.
You were one of the earliest candidates for the White House to put out a comprehensive plan for police reform. And in that plan, you called for ending what you called over-aggressive policing, which means what to you?
Over-aggressive policing is on display right now throughout our country. If you've seen these military-style vehicles or combat gear, any number of ways that the federal government has supplied the machinery of war to local police departments, and I think made things worse because it's given a lot of these police officers a combat mentality as they're dealing with civilians, whether it's peaceful protesters or just folks that they encounter all the time on the beat. I think that's the wrong direction to go in, and I called for demilitarizing the police. I also called for ending stop and frisk policies and racial profiling that too often have over-targeted people of color in different communities across this country.
But you know, Secretary Castro, we have heard promises and pledges from police departments in the past when there have been incidents of police brutality against people of color. And there are a lot of people who feel that nothing has really changed. So what needs to change if these policies or these pledges are to get traction?
We need the political will for these policies to change. That starts with citizens out there when they're considering a candidate for city council or for state representative or for Congress, asking those candidates about these issues, making it clear that this is important to them so that you elect people who are going to bring a new vision with better policies and make the changes that we need to make on police reform.
Well, now, let me ask you a question with practical implications. You have served as mayor of San Antonio, and we were just talking about on our broadcast yesterday a new report from Rice University, which looked at how cities, including San Antonio, Houston, Dallas, are all going to have budgets that will crater due to the ongoing pandemic and the implications for the economy. He believes that police and fire departments probably will be untouched as a result of that fallout, although other departments such as parks and other city services would be profoundly affected. Do you think that this is an opportunity to curb spending by police departments, or what would you recommend or putting your former mayor hat on?
No, I absolutely believe that police departments and fire departments should be subject to the same budget scrutiny. Crime in this country in most American cities has gone down considerably if you compare 2020 to 2000 or to 1990. So we can't be of the mindset that police funding can only go in one direction. We have to make sure that the resources are there. However, the percentage of the budget that police departments represent for most American cities has been going higher and higher. I don't know that that's the right direction. I actually think that they should get more scrutiny for those budgets.
I want to refer to something that happened yesterday, shortly after your full-throated endorsement of Joe Biden. He tweeted back and said something to the effect of, "Julian, I made a promise to George's family that he wouldn't just become another hashtag. We're going to tackle this head on, and we're going to need your help to do it. Grateful for your support." I think a lot of people are now wondering whether or not that was a tacit pledge to bring you on board in some function in a Biden administration. How did you read his remark?
I wouldn't put those words in his mouth. I would just say that Vice President Biden, for all of the time that I've known him, and obviously I worked with him in the Obama administration, has always been great about listening to the views of others. You know, he has said on the campaign trail that, you know, he wants to make sure that we're all working together as a team. For me, I have zero plans to go back to Washington, D.C., but, was glad to see that he's willing at least to take ideas on police reform. And I'm willing to give any ideas that we've put out already and to talk about those and be helpful however I can be.
Julian Castro is the former mayor of San Antonio, and he's also former Housing and Urban Development Secretary. Mr. Castro, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your schedule to speak with us. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Lots to chew on there in your interview with Julian Castro. And we're hearing from people about police reform at the local level. Here's some of the responses we're seeing. On Facebook, James Huffman says, "Police unions are not protecting officers from management as a union should. Instead, they are protecting the police from accountability. He says they should be busted. Officers should have to carry liability insurance, and there should be independent citizen review boards for every use of force." Meanwhile, Eric Ballantyne says, "I don't want police reform per se. Instead, I want better hiring and training filters." He says, "Generally, this is about local leadership, not bad cops." Just a couple of the perspectives we're seeing out there, David. Many, many more coming in, obviously, after civil unrest, protest, peaceful protest, and some flare-ups continue to occur in Texas cities and across the nation. I'll be back with more later in the program.
That's Wells Dunbar. He's our social media editor, and he'd love to hear from you. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. There's more of the Standard just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at TexasOncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Among the protests in the wake of the death of George Floyd, some in El Paso have been especially notable for the return of a group that first made a major mark during another era of mass demonstrations, the 1960s. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports.
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd!
Brown Berets of El Chuco organized the protest in downtown El Paso, demanding justice for George Floyd and an end to police brutality. They're a local chapter of the Chicano Civil Rights Organization, born in Los Angeles in the turbulent 1960s.
We're the next generation. We're going to keep the movement strong.
This man in his 30s would only give his name as Quetzalcoatl. That's the Aztec winged serpent. He's one of a handful of Brown Berets that led a protest march from a park to City Hall as a helicopter hovered overhead. There was a massive law enforcement presence, including police in riot gear, for about 150 protesters. Many were teenagers, like this 15-year-old high school freshman.
My grandmother brought me so she couldn't stay because she can't stand for long. But I'm dropped off with my friends. And so I was told to stay safe, so I wanted to stay on the front line as much as I can. Well, every time I see tension rising, I keep going back to the light post.
She said she was so afraid she would only give her nickname, Sam. Protesters were encouraged not only to take to the streets, but also turn out at the polls in November.
Vote!
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 Let me hear.
In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The electronics that power your cell phone are loaded with switches, components that allow the phone to change networks, get data, and keep you connected while on the move. Well, now a new kind of switch, developed by researchers at the University of Texas at Austin and the University of Lille in France, could make those connections significantly faster while dramatically improving your phone's battery life, especially when 5G networks become the standard a few years from now. Deji Akinwande joins us. He led the research that developed this new switch. He holds the David and Doris Liebarger Endowed Faculty Fellowship in Engineering at the University of Texas Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. Professor Akinwande, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Yes, David, it's a pleasure to be on this show today.
I think we've all heard that 5G networks will make our connections to the internet much faster, but the new component you and your colleagues have developed is supposed to increase speeds even more while dramatically, as I understand it, improving our phone's battery life. How does this technology actually work?
Yes, indeed. This is something, David, we've been working on for a couple of years. So one of the biggest challenges in today's smartphones, as you no doubt mentioned, is the battery life and the speed. So, for example, even when you're not using your phone, when you're in an idle state, let's say you're on a phone call, the switches in your phone that are designed to toggle between all the different bands, they're constantly operating even when you're idle. So they're constantly draining the battery even when they're not performing any switching operation. So that is one of the reasons why, you know, if you leave your phone for a few hours, you return to it, even though the display has been off, the battery has reduced from when you left it a few hours earlier. So the kind of switch that we have developed at the University of Texas is a very smart switch in the sense that it does not draw any power from the battery unless it's actually switching between the bands. So the current switches that are being used today are so-called transistor switches. So they need power to be operating and to be ready to respond at any time. The switches that we have developed, these are so-called memory switches. So it's based on the same memory component that is used to store your information, like your images and pictures and data. We've been able to now redesign this memory to operate as a switch for switching between communication. So the good thing or the advantage of a memory device is that by definition, the memory doesn't actually draw any power unless it's actually storing information or retrieving information.
I see. Now, in phones using these switches, how much longer would one expect the battery to run? And when it comes to download speeds, how much faster?
Almost all the phones today are under proprietary information. So we don't really know precisely how much of the battery life is consumed by switches. We do know that there could be up to hundreds of switches in a given smartphone. So the battery life is actually substantial. Indeed, the exact quantity we don't know yet, but with every generation, the consumption of battery power by the switches increases. In terms of the download speeds, we've actually tested that in the lab. So today, if you want to download a high definition movie, let's say of 2 hours or so, that may take you a few minutes if you're on a very good network. Now, with our switches, you can actually download that in a few seconds. In fact, we did a test in which you could download three high definition movies in 1 second. So it's extremely fast.
Now, is the technology difficult to actually make? I mean, you know, say on a production line, are you using some particular special kind of element for this switch?
We're using a new material. This material is called hexagonal boron nitride. This material is actually quite common. So It's very common and in virtually all makeup products, for example, many skincare products. It's very common as a lubricant. So it's, in a sense, you could say a commodity product. We are using what we call an electronic grade version of this. So it's a premium quality material. So this material can be grown and it can be integrated in a semiconductor production line used for making chips.
Is it expensive?
Many people would say it's always expensive in the beginning, but with time, as more products are made and as the volume increases, the price will come down substantially.
How soon do you think it would be before we might have these in our own cell phones?
That is a tough question. The reason it's tough is so far we've made, let's say, a few dozens of these switches. If you're talking about 5G phones, the volumes that you need are hundreds of millions of these switches. So we have a huge gap in terms of production capability. So for that reason, it would take several years before this can go from an academic lab to an industrial product that is being made in a reliable way at an affordable price at hundreds of millions of volume per year.
Deji Akinwande is a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UT Austin. He and his team just published their research in the journal Nature Electronics. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure, really, to be here today.
We are, in the meantime, keeping Tropical Storm Cristobal in focus. It's made landfall on the Mexican Gulf Coast and could potentially start affecting U.S. Gulf Coast by this weekend. Weather Channel reporting that the storm is forecast to linger near the Bay of Campeche in eastern Mexico through the end of the week before moving north. Now, meteorologists say at this point it could make landfall anywhere from the upper Texas Gulf Coast across to the Florida Panhandle. Of course, we will keep you updated right here on the Texas Standard. Fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Texas congressman is working on legislation to declare a war on racism and create a U.S. Department of Reconciliation following the police killing of George Floyd. Houston Democrat Al Green said on C-SPAN this morning the nation has failed to reconcile its differences.
And the only way we can get to it, as I see it, is to lift it to the highest level of government, to have it become a department, just as we have a Department of Labor, a Department of Defense, have a Department of Reconciliation that is to take immediate and long-term action, develop a strategy and implement it to eliminate racism and invidious discrimination in our country.
Congressman Green on Tuesday attended the Houston March honoring Floyd. Governor Greg Abbott appeared with local leaders in North Texas Tuesday to address ongoing protests against police violence throughout Texas. KERA's Brett Jaspers reports.
Abbott came to North Texas to appear with the mayors of Dallas and Fort Worth. He called the death of George Floyd a horrific act of police brutality and said we must ensure something like that never happens in Texas. Abbott was asked several times about specific policies he would support to counteract police brutality. He didn't give any details.
I think it's important that we have the opportunity to be able to have dialogue with all legislators and round out the completeness of all these issues, consider the pros and cons and modifications to any of these issues. And so one-off answers are incomplete. We need to have the complete dialogue of everybody in the House and Senate.
Abbott said the rioting and vandalism seen at protests is overshadowing Floyd's death. The governor said he won't ask the U.S. military to come to Texas. He also reported the federal government has not asked Texas to send its National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. Several states are sending National Guard troops to the nation's capital at President Trump's request. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Cinemark Theaters, the nation's third largest cinema chain, is planning a phased reopening of its U.S. locations starting in the Dallas-Fort Worth area this month. The Plano-based company says five Metroplex theaters will begin testing new social distancing and disinfectant protocols June 19th. CEO Mark Zorati outlined the next steps during an investor conference call.
Then the following week, we will open up approximately one-third of our theaters. Those will be generally in the larger theaters in larger markets. And then we'll open up one-third of the theaters in the following week. And then the final third will all be open by July 10th.
Cinemark today reported it lost nearly $60 million in the first quarter due to closures. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas A&M University's flagship campus in College Station, as well as 10 of its other campuses across Texas, will be reopening this fall. This past Friday, its Board of Regents approved the university's plan to have in-person classes in the fall semester, as well as offering remote and online learning courses to maintain social distancing during the pandemic. Joining us now to tell us more about the plan is John Sharp. He is Chancellor of the Texas A&M University System. Chancellor Sharp, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your schedule to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Glad to, David. Thank you.
So what's behind the university system's decision to reopen campuses to in-person classes this fall? I think some other schools are still weighing their options.
We're strongly of the opinion that you can get a degree online, but it's real hard to become an Aggie online because the Aggie experience, not just at our flagship, but also at our other 10 universities, depends a great deal on camaraderie, on student reactions, interactions, on friendships, the spirit that exists not only at football games, but a whole lot of other things. The university experience is much more than simply an online education.
It's interesting you should mention football, because I recall back, I guess it must have been at the end of April, there were a lot of headlines out at that time, and some of them were quoting you as saying, we want to get back to campus, and we want to get back to football in the fall. What about football at Texas A&M?
We desperately want to do that. We want football to be open, but we don't get to call that shot. That shot's going to be called by the SEC and to some extent the NCAA. There's lots of options there that I'm sure they're looking at. I'm sure one of the options that they're looking at is, you know, players on the field with a TV camera, players on the field with the student body, and all the way up to opening it up. And we'll know that when the time comes. But if you're one of those campuses that say right now, like some of them have, oh, we're not going to have football, and all of a sudden this thing is over with 30 or 60 days from now, then you've just deprived, you know, not only your students, but your former students of an experience that's important to the university.
Getting back to academics, not all classes will be in person, though, even if campus is reopened, right?
Well, we will have classes in person, but they will also, we call them high flex classes, they'll also be online. For instance, if you're a student that is nervous about class, maybe you have diabetes, maybe you have high blood pressure and those things that are flashpoints and danger points, you'll be able to go to that class online and not have to go into the classroom. At the same time, if you are a professor and you have those same kinds of things, we'll have a way for you to broadcast interactively into that classroom.
What about libraries and dining halls? Will they be open or limited capacity or what?
That is our plan. They'll be open. We'll follow the same social distancing that the CDC requires. One of the things that we're doing also is on dormitories on campus. Mm-hmm. We found a way to test the effluent as it comes out through the sewer system. And in that effluent, if we see that there is COVID-19 virus in that effluent, then we go back into that dormitory and find out who has it and do the test. We're in the process now of accumulating the tests for each of our campuses that'll be there, that we can test folks, and if somebody tests positive, you know, they're going to be required to self-isolate and things like that.
there's been a real back and forth, a tug of war of ideas over how soon is too soon to reopen campuses. Do you feel that pressure, that burden? I mean, what if this were to spread, and in part because a student felt like he wanted to get back to campus and the campus was open?
We think we're going to have adequate protections in to protect not only our students, but the faculty and staff and the folks that are there. They've been working on this, you know, literally 24/7 for about 3 months, including the tests, including the antiviral tests, including antibody tests, mm-hmm. and all kinds of things. And we think that they'll be just as safe, if not safer, here as they would be if they were, you know, running around Dallas or Houston or any place else.
John Sharp is the chancellor of the Texas A&M University System. Chancellor Sharp, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Glad to. Thank you, David.
You've probably heard of Nazi symbols being used to deface headstones in cemeteries, but what about those carved by the U.S. government on headstones? More coming up as the Standard continues.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Department of Veterans Affairs has reversed course and agreed to remove three gravestones in veterans cemeteries engraved with swastikas. These stones mark the burial sites of German POWs who died in the U.S. during World War II. Critics say the VA didn't act quickly enough. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
The gravestones are at national cemeteries in San Antonio and Salt Lake City. They each show a swastika. Two have an inscription that reads, "He died far from his home for the Führer, people, and fatherland." The stones have been there more than 70 years, nestled among the white marble markers of American service members. Though they were the subject of occasional news stories, they went mostly unnoticed until May, when the Military Religious Freedom Foundation threatened legal action.
We want the denazification.
Mikey Weinstein is an Air Force veteran and lawyer for the organization.
Get rid of the swastika and get rid of the homages to Hitler, the Third Reich, and the German people that are supporting them.
It's not unusual for German soldiers to be buried in U.S. cemeteries, especially those that were near POW camps in World War II. But their gravestones usually only include names and dates of death. It's not clear why these are different. Weinstein says he acknowledges POWs should be honorably buried, but takes exception to displaying the swastika, which is now illegal in Germany.
Even if, you know, we have to provide them a burial with some sort of marker or whatever, that is light years. That is galaxies away from putting up the swastika symbol itself.
The VA initially resisted the change, citing U.S. laws about historic preservation. In May, VA Secretary Robert Wilkie testified before the House Armed Services Committee, saying he didn't want to erase the Holocaust from memory by removing the stones. Instead, he said he'd look at ways of putting them into historical context.
I happen to think that making sure that when people visit our cemeteries, they are educated and informed of the horror is an incredibly important thing to do.
But by June, under increasing pressure from lawmakers and the media, the VA reversed course, saying it would start the process required by law to replace the stones. Wilkie said in a statement that it was, quote, understandably upsetting for veterans and their families to see Nazi inscriptions near the graves of American service members. The VA also said it would propose keeping the old headstones in the National Cemetery Administration's history collection. The VA hasn't responded to questions about what caused Wilkie to change course. The Military Religious Freedom Foundation says it's pleased with the decision, but will continue to press VA for quick action and an apology.
It's incredibly cowardly of the VA secretary to suddenly, you know, develop this tremendous zeal to protect people from the Nazi headstones. You know, he testified just a few days before the United States Congress with a pretty strong degree of resolution to keep them there.
This isn't the first time the U.S. has confronted the question of how to appropriately treat the graves of enemy service members. In Hampton, Virginia, dozens of German soldiers and sailors are buried at the National Cemetery, including many crew members of sunken U-boats from World War II. Each year, American and German service members and community members gather in the area for memorial services. Franz Josef Paulus is a retired German Army colonel and a longtime liaison between the U.S. and German militaries. He's taken part in a few of the ceremonies.
It's for me very important that if somebody has paid the ultimate sacrifice, that their families, loved ones, and friends honor the graves.
Paulus says it's possible to honor German service members without elevating Nazi ideology and the swastika.
It's still symbolizing a state or a regime which is not following international rules and didn't follow international rules. The guy who is buried there, he has to be honored, but not the symbol. I would like to differentiate between that.
In the Virginia Cemetery, the grave markers simply display the service members' names, ranks, nationalities, and dates. The VA hasn't said what will be on the new gravestones in Texas and Utah. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
The American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. To much of the world, and to many people in the U.S. who've never been to Texas, the state is a vast desert. Okay, maybe not the Sahara, but nonetheless a place of high plains, rocky mesas, sweeping wall-like cliffs, and dusty canyons. Now, certainly there are parts of West Texas where you'd find such features, but more than half the state is green, with rolling hills, lush forests, and vibrant coastal plains. So why is it that the desert seems to dominate the popular imagination of Texas among non-Texans? Commentator W.F. Strong says, blame Hollywood.
There are many John Wayne westerns with storylines that meander through Texas, but the films were mostly shot in Utah and northern or southern Arizona. The most jarring example to me is The Searchers. To my mind, The Searchers was John Wayne's best film. Here's a clip where Mrs. Jorgensen, a tough frontier woman, defines these early Texans.
It just so happens we be Texicans. Texican is nothing but a human man way out on a limb this year and next, maybe for 100 more. But I don't think it'll be forever. Someday this country's gonna be a fine, good place to be. Maybe it needs our bones in the ground before that time can come.
As she says this on her front porch, she is facing Monument Valley, Utah. Wayne made 5 movies in Monument Valley, even though 2 of them, The Searchers and The Rio Grande, had storylines that based them in Texas. Wayne actually said, Monument Valley is the place where God put the West. Another Wayne film that is shocking to a native Texan is The Comancheros. The plot has Wayne playing Texas Ranger Jake Cutter, great name. He arrests an outlaw for murder on a boat arriving in Galveston, and tells him he will return him to Louisiana.
Well, I've committed no crime in Texas.
Right. But you killed a man in Louisiana. My job's to take you to the Ranger headquarters where a Louisiana marshal will pick you up, take you back to New Orleans and the gallows. You know, we're getting real obliging to the states down here in Texas. A lot of folks want to join the Union.
There's a couple of hundred in gold in that jacket. Does that give you any ideas, friend?
I've got what you might consider a weakness. I'm honest.
As Cutter exits the boat in Galveston with his handcuffed prisoner, Paul Regret, in tow, he walks right into southeastern Utah, where the film was shot in Professor Valley and the La Salle Mountains, among other places near Moab. Stunning country for CinemaScope technology to capture, but it's not Texas. Rio Bravo and El Dorado were 2 John Wayne films with Texas settings, shot in and around the Sonoran Desert west of Tucson. The landscape there is dominated by thousands of saguaros, enormous 40-foot cacti that look like sentinels of the desert. Such sites don't exist in Texas. Clint Eastwood's For a Few Dollars More is set in and around El Paso, but it was actually shot in the Tabernas Desert near Almeria, Spain. Fort Bravo, also called Texas Hollywood, is a movie set town built there in the 60s and has served as a backdrop for many classic Western films like Once Upon a Time in the West, and the famous spaghetti westerns. Not all of those have Texas storylines, but some do. For a few dollars more does. And at least in this case, the landscape of Almeria is a good match for the El Paso region. Everything is bigger in Texas because Hollywood has subconsciously created a much wider world in the collective mind of moviegoers. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, RGV. You can check out more of his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. A PolitiFact check and more of the talk of Texas as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As President Donald Trump pledged to crack down on violence at protests against police brutality happening across the country, he highlighted an incident caught on video in Dallas. He said in a Rose Garden speech, quote, "Innocent people have been savagely beaten like the young man in Dallas, Texas, who was left dying on the street." Is that story true? Madeline Meckelberg is here to look into the president's claim. She's with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So I think the president was referring to a video that made the rounds on social media, and he made a specific reference to this incident that was depicted in his speech in the Rose Garden, where he was demanding a greater crackdown by governors, right?
That's exactly right. He was threatening the use of military force in these communities where we're seeing reports of violence during these protests. And he made a speech. He attributed some of the action to Antifa and other organized protesters. And we've got audio of his remark.
Our nation has been gripped by professional anarchists, violent mobs, arsonists, looters, criminals, rioters, Antifa, and others. A number of state and local governments have failed to take necessary action to safeguard their residents. Innocent people have been savagely beaten, like the young man in Dallas, Texas, who was left dying on the street.
So Trump actually tweeted a video of this assault that he's talking about over the weekend. The video was taken on Saturday in Dallas during protests there, and it's a very graphic video, and it was shared multiple times. There were different angles of the event, but Trump retweeted somebody who was sharing the video, attributing the attack to these anti-fascist activists. And the video itself is about 25 seconds, and it shows more than a dozen people stomping and kicking a man who's laying on the ground in the street. And in the video, people can be seen, you know, throwing things at him. One person hits him over the head with a skateboard. After about 15 seconds of that, the crowd sort of dissipates, and the camera shows the man. He's motionless on the ground. His body's contorted. The pavement around his head is red with blood. And that's the video that Trump retweeted. That's the incident he's talking about here.
Is it known who this person is and whatever happened to him?
There were photos that were posted after this video was taken showing the man sitting up. He's receiving treatment from volunteer medics. The police department did tell me that the man's being treated at a local hospital in stable condition, so he did not die. He's not dying, as Trump said in his remark, but we don't know information about his identity.
What about those who instigated this assault? The president blamed Antifa for it. And I suppose we should explain what Antifa is, because there's a lot of confusion about whether this is a real organization or a single organization or just what.
Right. So the important thing here is that we actually don't know how this assault started. The video that Trump shared was short, and the longer video shows some, but definitely not all of the events leading up to the assault. It shows a man charging across an intersection in downtown Dallas towards the group of demonstrators wielding what kind of looks like a long blade. Police later confirmed that he was carrying a machete. And as he's running towards the crowd, the protesters scream and many of them run away, but some of them charge towards the man with the weapon and start to beat him. And that's where this shorter video starts that the president shared. So it wasn't so simple as these people instigated a fight, the man charged at them with a weapon. And Dallas police right now are investigating the incident, but they haven't made any arrests or confirmed the identity of any of the people involved.
And Antifa, we should point out, is an organization, a loose organization of groups that claim that there needs to be greater social justice in the country. They are often resistors to President Trump, and they've been blamed for acts of violence in other places. But again, it's not a single group, at least as Antifa has been used in the popular media.
That's exactly right, David.
Okay, so all told, how do you go about assessing this claim? Is there a way to have an actual rating?
So we didn't rate this claim. There were a lot of things said about this video. Trump shared it multiple times. Right now, we don't know the identity of anybody involved. So we're just offering some context here, sharing what we actually know about this thing that happened.
Madeline Meckelberg is with PolitiFact Texas, which is based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, thanks for the context.
Thanks for chatting with me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and he's got more of the talk of Texas right now. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, we're continuing to hear from folks about policing reforms pitched by Julian Castro at the top of the show. A wide range of responses we're seeing here, David, via Facebook. This interesting comment here from Joanne Robison. Joanne writes, I'd like to see decriminalization of many small activities, starting with little things. How about a reminder stop when a brake light is out or someone forgets to use a turn signal instead of a warning or a ticket? How about an air horn reminder not to pass a bus instead of a fine? I suspect most offenders just didn't notice. Joanne goes on to say there is lots of room to change our relationship with the police. Fines and confinement hurt the poor the most and increase resentment in minority communities. And Patrick Schubert calls out a similar problem that Julian Castro noted, the militarization of the police. Patrick writes, it seems to me if you tell someone that they are a hammer, everyone else starts to look like a nail. It has to end. So it will be fascinating to see how much of that, policing reform plank that Julian Castro ran on during his bid in the presidential primary there, how much of that could be incorporated, the sort of influence that the former San Antonio mayor could have over Joe Biden once it gets closer to the Democratic convention and election day. You know, just also interested in taking the pulse of our friends and listeners out there, David. Obviously, I don't have to tell you there is a lot of stuff going on out there and not much of it very positive. The unrest, the protest against police violence, and all this, of course, transpiring in the background of a global pandemic. So it's good to hear from folks and just sort of hear from our friends and listeners and hear what's on their minds. Hear some of those reactions via Facebook as well. Oscar Garcia asks if the protest will help bring long-lasting and wide-ranging change. He's asking, how can we protect protesters and the people they know from COVID-19? And he just adds that he is tired, so tired by the turn of events that he's seeing in the world today. Wanda Compton echoes those frustrations. She describes utter frustration and helplessness at many of the news items that she sees today. Laura Cohen notes similar feelings, fear and anger, but she also notes that she's celebrating her oldest child's birthday today and notes how grateful she is for her and hopeful that she and her more enlightened peers will do even better, she writes on Facebook. So obviously, people trying to temper those sorts of feelings of anger, frustration with some optimism out there, David.
As we earlier in the broadcast, we're talking Chancellor Sharp of the Texas A&M system. We realized that as we were speaking, the Texas Tribune started reporting that the University of Texas has announced that about 20% of its classes will be taught remotely this fall. Students who choose not to return to campus can take all their courses online. More on this story and much more from the news across the Lone Star State tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.